นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนมัสสามิFirstly, I'd like to apologize for not being present for the Eight Precepts ceremony yesterday evening. I had a scheduling glitch. Forgot to put things into my calendar, so my regrets. I'll try to be more mindful next week. So this next talk, this is chapter 20 in the collection of Lumpur Sumedho's teachings, volume 3. These are talks from the book The Way It Is, and this one is called Non-Dualism. A significant offering of the Buddhist teaching lies in what we call non-dualism. It's the neither-nor, quote-unquote, approach to philosophical questions. Monistic religion tends to talk about the one God, the whole, the Buddha nature, or the one mind. And that's very inspiring. We turn to monistic doctrines for inspiration. But inspiration is only one level of religious experience. And you have to outgrow it. You have to let go of the desire for inspiration, the belief in God, the oneness, the one mind, or all-embracing benevolence, or universal fairness. So this word monistic is not a very common term in ordinary everyday English. So it looks a bit like monastic, so you can think it's a misprint. But it's kind of related that both words come from the Greek monos, meaning one. So a monistic, M-O-N-I-S-T-I-C, monistic religion or monistic philosophy is one that talks about oneness and unity or wholeness in that kind of respect. So this is why Lumpur's speaking about it here, and also is a major theme for this Dhamma teaching. So when I read that word, please bear in mind it's not just another word for monastic, but it's really that it's a philosophical approach of talking about oneness. And then in terms of non-dualism, so he says it's the neither-nor approach to philosophical questions. So in Indian philosophy, so non-dualism, probably many people are familiar with the term Advaita, Advaita Vedanta as an approach to spiritual practice from the Indian tradition. So that literally is what the source of the English word, the translation of the English word non-dual or non-dualism. A means not, dva means two, advaita. So the way of not two-ness. So advā, not two, non-dual. And so also you might have heard the term neti-neti. It's a Sanskrit term meaning not this, not that. So it's also points to that way of negation, and in this teaching, when Lumpur uses the phrase "it's the neither nor approach," then I'm reading that as him referring to that neti neti, n e t i n e t i, neti neti, not this, not that. So a way of turning the attention aside from the habitual dualistic ways of thinking, subject here, object there, or what he calls the monistic religion or monistic approaches, speaking about oneness. And so this is one of the subtle areas of the Buddha's teaching, and one of the ways that it can come across as nihilistic or kind of life negating. And it was very common that when the Buddha was speaking and teaching Dhamma on a level of this kind of profundity, or speaking about not attaching to the ideas of oneness or the all, which I'll read a quote in a minute with respect to that, then he was considered to be one who was what they call in Pali a bunohuno, which means a wrecker of being or a destroyer of being. So people heard the Buddha speaking and talking about nibbana or letting go of rebirth, or not wanting to be, not seeing yourself as an Atman that needs to be reunited with Brahman and such like, or that Brahman is the one, the sort of embodiment of being. And when the Buddha spoke about not being born or say the realization of nibbana and cessation of dukkha and such like, then it was quite common for him to be misunderstood as espousing as or promoting a doctrine of nihilism or of being a wrecker of being, a destroyer, or of being anti-life or anti the philosophies that promote the qualities of wholeness or oneness. So the Buddha was used to being misunderstood, misrepresented, and over again he addressed that and made it clear. He said, I do not teach the destruction of an existent being. What I speak about is suffering and the ending of suffering. So he was frequently, say, criticized in that way, and the theme for Lumpur's talk here is a lot around that, and the challenge of letting go of those kind of inspiring, gladdening, uplifting philosophies about oneness, wholeness, and such like. So, to continue, I'm not asking you to disbelieve in those things either. But the non-dualistic practice is a way of letting go of all of that, of seeing the attachment to views, opinions, and perceptions, because the perception of one's mind is a perception. The perception of a universal benevolence is a perception to which we can attach. The Buddha nature is a perception. Buddha is a perception. The one God and everything as one universal system, a global village where all is one and one is all, everything is fair and everything is kind, and God loves us. These are perceptions which might be very nice, but they're still perceptions which arise and cease. Perceptions of monistic doctrines arise and cease. So can people follow this? Say no if you can't. It's a subtle area of teaching, but one that's very important. Any questions? Yes, please. Anagarika, Anna Marie.
Yeah, so I would like to ask Ajahn if, what is the difference when Longpoor saying, for example, in the last Dhamma talk, like to trust in this awareness and that you don't really have to do anything or not to achieve anything, and you're physically almost already pure. For me, it's like totally similar to the Buddha nature concept, for example. So what is the main difference? Or, if you could just comment.
Yeah, good question. The way I read this is like the idea of Buddha nature, those are words, the idea of that is a perception. Buddha is a perception. So that, and then later on he talks about the Buddha Rupa. But it's attachment to the perceptions. So in that, say, when he was talking in the Dhammadesana yesterday, time disappears very easily. So yesterday afternoon, saying we're all perfect already, and to trust in that awareness, that it's the actual quality of that knowing, that awakened awareness, which is not a concept, it's not a perception, it's a quality of the citta. So I would say it's the difference between attaching to the idea of the Buddha or the memory or the knowledge about the Buddha or about Buddha nature, but actually that as I understand it, using the term Buddha nature is a very reasonable and valid way of talking about the quality of awareness. And when the Buddha, and he had that dialogue, I quoted a couple of times in these readings, the dialogue with the Brahmin donor, And Adona finds the Buddha sitting under a tree, and he's kind of amazed by his radiance and his presence and this peacefulness. And he says, "Well, you know, what are you? Are you a deva?" He says, "No, I'm not. I could be known or called a deva is that's not attached to. That's not identified with." He says, Are you a Brahma? Are you a Yaka? Are you a celestial demon? And then he says, are you a Manusa? Are you a human being? And he says, no, in exactly the same words, you know, that whereby I could be identified as a human being that has been abandoned, let go of, cut off like a palm stump. And then the Brahmin donor says, what are you? And then the Buddha says, you can know me as that which is awake, Buddhosmi. So that he defines what his own nature, or the nature of this quality, as buddho, as awake, wakefulness. And so that when we talk about Buddha nature, and I'm very aware that people within the southern school of Buddhism and connection with the Pali teachings say, no, Buddha nature is completely, it's a heretical doctrine, it's a complete misunderstanding. But I think just in the colloquial usage of the term Buddha nature, that which is of the nature of Buddha, of buddho, of awakened awareness, of knowing, that is what we're meaning when we talk about the Buddha refuge, or it's that awareness itself. I would say that in ordinary, so everyday usage or colloquial usage of terms like Buddha nature, that's quite comparable. I'm not an expert in different areas of Buddhist philosophy. So maybe when a Chinese person or someone who studied Chinese Buddhism talks about Buddha nature, or someone from the Tibetan schools, or someone from Japan or Korea and so forth, they might use the words in slightly different ways. But to me, that nature, or that quality of the heart, which is awake and aware and which is reliable, that's what Lumpur's talking about as consciousness, in the way he uses that term, or awakened awareness. So it's the difference between the word temple and the actuality of this building. Like, one is a word that is a referring to the thing in itself, and the other is the thing in itself. So that's how I read that. Does that make sense? And that, and then going to his point yesterday, saying, you know, we're all perfect. It's like, if you recognize, again, as I said a few times, if you take a principle like the jitta is dhamma, the jitta is dhamma, the mind is dhamma, it's not a person. Then it's like if you recognize that everything that you are is an aspect of Dhamma, when Lumpur says you're perfect already, saying the Dhamma is perfect already. Nothing needs to be added, nothing needs to be taken away. Because when all of the perceptions and aspects of identity are let go of, then what's here but the Dhamma? So that, but taking the idea, I'm the Dhamma, that's what I am, I'm perfect already, I don't need to do anything, then that's the ego hijacking the vehicle, I would say. And that's sort of and if you believe that, then basically you're crazy. You know, I mean, not you individually, us. If we believe that I in this individuality, in this sort of personhood, I am the Dhamma, I am the ultimate reality, then that's in a way almost a sort of textbook definition of craziness, because it's like the ego sort of claiming to own the universe. Or like many years ago I think when I was a high school student, and there was a history lesson talking about these European invaders in South America standing on the shore of the Pacific Ocean, saying, you know, I claim this ocean for the throne of Spain. Like, I think it was on a peak in Darien. Like, yes, this belongs to me. Like, it's ridiculous. Like, standing out in the field in Amravati and say, I own the sky. I declare this is all mine. I'm the owner of the universe. It's like, if you believe that, then you need help. You know, we're crazy if we believe that. Or like, you can claim an ocean and everything in it for a European country. It's like, It's a, I would say, with all due respect to the history books, that's a kind of madness to say, you know, I am the owner of this belongs to me, you know, this is under my control, and that has to be a sort of deluded and partial perception of things. So again, it's one of those instances where you really need to be alert to the level that the teaching is being given on. If it's being expressed from a place of transcendence rather than from the sort of personal point of view. So when you take an idea like the mind is Dhamma, it's not a person, or I am perfect already, then that I am is not the ego, it's not Anagarika and Marie. That's the voice of the Dhamma. It is a Dhamma desana, it's a demonstration of Dhamma, an embodiment of Dhamma. So it's in a way the Dhamma saying that it's perfect, that nothing needs to be added, nothing needs to be taken away, that fundamental integrative principle is intrinsically perfect and pure. So that from that, on the human level, yeah, we've got lots to do. Lots of improvements can be made, things to be developed, things to be let go of. Otherwise, we wouldn't talk about a path, you know, the Magga. And so the Buddha, most of his teaching, I'd say 99% of it, is on the tangible human level. And a small proportion is from the transcendent level. So he talks about a path and development and so on. But at its very core, like Lumpo Cha used this expression, being Dhamma. So there's hearing Dhamma, understanding Dhamma, practicing Dhamma, realizing Dhamma. And then the final piece of that process is being Dhamma. And it's not like you weren't Dhamma before and now you become it, but like digging through the layers of identification and attachment and recognizing, oh, that's what was the very basis of this. Was Dhamma all along. That's what was at the very heart of it. This is the nature of what we call this being, that it's not really a being at all. You know, as a living being is really an agreement, you know, that it's deciding to call this particular set of experiences me, I, or you. And it's a set of conventions that are put together. But at the very core, the more the heart awakens to its own nature, it's like Dhamma awakening to its own nature, then those personal, individual, time-based, located aspects are seen through, let go of. And then the fundamental reality of Dhamma, which is, you know, timeless, unlocated, non-personal, that becomes apparent. Okay? So also, another thing I'd like to say about this, the Pali word atamayata, I mentioned it the other day, so the translation of that is again means not, or it's a negation at the beginning. Tam comes from from the Pali meaning, you know, that. And then the mayata means made of, so or maya, made of, and then ta-ness, so not made of that-ness. So the way I read it and understand it and work with it, I feel it's atamayata is the Pali expression for Advaita, and not to. So not made of that, it's a letting go of subject-object duality, it's a letting go of that. The knower and the known as sort of separate dual entities, letting go of thatness, and it's taken in the scriptures as a kind of the most sort of refined quality of awareness, and it's a clarity of knowing, a clarity of seeing. And Ajahn Buddhadasa, in the last couple of years of his life, he made that the theme for most of his Dhamma talks, atamayata, And that it was a word he was trying to resuscitate and bring into common use in the Buddhist world. And so he first started talking about it, I think, in about 87 or 88. And then for the last few years of his life, it was a very, thoroughly used theme. And he called it the final word of Buddhism, like the last word. It's like the most... referring to the most refined quality of wisdom or awareness. And so he made an extension of the three characteristics of existence, the first three, anicca, dukkha, anatta, most people here are familiar with, but uncertainty or impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. So those are the first three tas, like anicca-ta, dukkha-ta, anatta-ta. And he uses the pun, the word ta in Pali means nest. So like anicca-ta means impermanence or transitoriness. And then dukkha-ta means unsatisfactoriness. And then anatta-ta means not selfness. So, but the word ta in Thai means the eye, the eye organ. So he called these the nine eyes, or the nine ways of seeing clearly. So the next three are dhamma niyamata, all things that exist function according to the laws of dhamma. They are function according to the laws of nature. They are dhamma titata. They are formed according to the laws of nature. Tittati is to stand or to be established. So dhamma niyamata, dhamma tittata, and then iddhapachayata means it's the law of conditionality. So that those are all another three characteristics of all existent things. Dhamma niyamata, dhamma tittata, and iddhapachayata, if I'm remembering these correctly. And then the last three are sunyata, emptiness, tatata, suchness, and atamayata. So the last three he would spoke of as the most refined characteristics of all things. So all things are empty of substance. They are sunyata. They have the characteristic of emptiness. Tatata, they have the characteristic of suchness. And then atamayata, they have the characteristic of not made of thatness, or not thatness. And so in this book that Ajahn Sano and I put together, The Island, this is the newest edition, there's a whole chapter in there on atamayata, if you're interested in following that up. Chapter 6, I believe. So you can read up on it if you like. But I do feel it I took Ajahn Buddhadasa's teachings to heart. I went and stayed there at Wat Suan Mok for a couple of weeks in 1988, was very grateful to hear his teachings and to hear him discoursing on that. It was not a word I'd ever heard before, but he really was emphasizing it a lot. And it is really, I feel, this the same area that Lumpur Sumedha is talking about here, about non-duality, and that's that kind of total letting go, and it's like a subjectless, objectless awareness, where there isn't a sense of a me watching that, or me looking at the world, or me watching my mind, but it's like a complete wakefulness without that being divided into a subject and object. And that quality, I think the other day I mentioned it's very comparable to the quality of vijja, which we also translate as awakened awareness. So I feel that those are very closely related qualities. Again, I'm not an academic. I haven't read any treatises about comparing Advaita Vedanta and Atamayata. Maybe someone's written a PhD about that, but if they have, I'm not aware of it. But just reflecting on these teachings and putting these principles into action and seeing how they work in experience, I feel that they're very close to each other, and that they're reflecting that as a quality of mental clarity, clarity of awareness, before the mind forms subject-object, the sankhara, and the sense of me as an individual entity moving around in the world. So to continue. What happens as a practical experience when you let things go and they cease? What's left? What's the remainder? This is what the Buddha is pointing to in teaching about the arising and cessation of conditions. When the perception of self ceases, and all the doctrines, all the inspired teaching, all the wise sayings cease, there is still the knower of the cessation, more views. And that leaves us with a blank mind. What is there to grasp? So the desire to know, to have something to grasp, comes up. We can sometimes see a kind of panic in our minds. We've got to believe in something. Tell me about the universal benevolence. But that's fear and desire operating again. I want to believe in something. I need something to believe in. I want to know that everything's all right. I want to attach to and believe in the perceptions of oneness and wholeness. That desire, which you may not notice and may still be attached to, is still operating. That's why the religious experience is often one of despair. So again, this is a challenging teaching, and we can unconsciously, or perhaps consciously, have a habit of hanging on to inspiration or something, some hope, some image to believe in or to take refuge in or to have as our basis of faith and trust. But this is challenging. And if you remember a few readings ago, Lumpur was talking about the spiritual holocaust, the total burning, the complete letting go. So, and again, it's this kind of challenging our sort of fondest attachments, even our spiritual attachments, of letting go of all of the structures, the forms, the isms, and the inspiring people that we have in our life, the inspiring figures. It's like let go that too that as well. Let go. In the Christian tradition, there's I think it's St. John of the Cross, in his book called The Ascent of Mount Carmel, he uses the image of climbing a mountain, describing various different spiritual paths. And the one I took note of was the one which is sort of the most direct and challenging route, which is kind of straight up the side of the mountain. You don't even follow a path that zigzags up, or it's straight up the side of the mountain. And he describes it as nothing. The Spanish is nada, 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 like nothing, 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 and even on the mountain, nothing. So it's like, it carries that same kind of spirit of like, let go, let go, let go, let go. Yeah, that as well, and that one, and that one, and that one. Yes, all of it, let go. And so that to that in us which likes to have things or ideas or forms or beings, and that we take refuge in or have been important for us, and that we have gratitude for, and such like, there can be these conscious or unconscious qualities of identification. We can have taken refuge in things, and that in that, not recognizing that this is a thing, and that all sabbe sankhara dukkha, if it's a thing, it's necessarily unable to satisfy. It's unreliable, it's uncertain, it's anicca. And so this kind of teaching challenges all those areas where that kind of identification and attachment is still carrying on, to Buddhism, to the teacher, to your fond memories, your everything. And I think the last reading we had is also not just the positive and inspiring things. It's also can be the things that you resent, the things you love to hate, or your unforgivable crimes that you've committed, your shortcomings. It's like sometimes that can be harder to let go of than anything else. And again, quoting another sort of non-Buddhist teacher, Gurdjieff, who's a famous sort of influential spiritual teacher of the 20th century, and when he was asked about the spiritual practice, he will say, one of the things that he said, and again, I might be misquoting this, but it's something along the lines of, people are ready to let go of anything except for their suffering. They'll hang on to that until death. In a way, the precious things are easier to let go of than my pain or my problem or my wrongness and my suffering. That can be a profound attachment that we're not particularly aware of. And so and in this era, Lumpur talked about it, not in this. In this particular teaching, but in this period, he often used, again, back into the European field of spiritual exploration again, he often would quote from Hermann Hesse's book, The Journey to the East, which again, I suspect a number of people here have read or familiar with. And the story of the Journey to the East is that this group of spiritual aspirants set out on this journey to the East, going to Asia, with this goal of enlightenment and spiritual liberation. And along the way, they come to this valley called Morbio Inferiore, the Valley of Despair. And I haven't read the book for a long, long time, but my memory of it is that when they're in the middle of the Valley of Despair, the one who is the narrator of the book, the one who's telling the story, he becomes overwhelmed by his feeling of failure, and it's so desperately difficult and painful that he turns back and he gives up on the journey to the East and returns to his life in Europe to sort of bumble along and get by in his ordinary world. Again, that's probably misquoting it a little bit, but he feels that the others are deluded and that they're all going to die, and so he turns back and goes back to his regular life in Europe and leaves the others to carry on. And then right at the end of the book, this is spoiler alert, right at the end of the book, then the person who was leading the pilgrimage, he reconnects some 30 or 40 years later with the one who turned back and gave up, and they have a sort of crucial conversation, and the fellow recognizes, oh yeah, it was my kind of spiritual lack of spiritual vision that made me turn back, I didn't see that I just had to work with that quality of despair, and he saw that the one who was leading the pilgrimage, yes, they did make it through and they did get to their East, so obviously a symbolic of spiritual realization, and that they had achieved their goal, they had arrived at that. And so Lumpur Sumedho in this period in the late 80s was often talking about Morbio Inferiore, the Valley of Despair, and that if you're experiencing that in the holy life, don't think that everything's gone wrong. don't read it as the one who turned back, but rather, this is part of the process. Okay, this is the Valley of Despair experience. This is doesn't mean that anything's going wrong or that you've failed or that anything's out of order. This is part of that journey that you've undertaken. So don't look at it as a failure or a disaster. Don't turn back. And so that was a very regular theme of Lumpur during this time. In the story of the crucifixion, the most impressive statement Christ made was, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? What happened to the God who was protecting Jesus? Even God left him. That's an anguished cry. The one perception I could count on suddenly dissolved in his mind. And after that, of course, came the acceptance and then the resurrection, the being born anew to be free from all that illusion, from all that attachment to God, attachment to the doctrine, attachment to even the highest ideas and the finest values. All these things are still very good and praiseworthy, but it's through attachment that we suffer. Because if we attach to any perception, we're not realizing the truth. We're just attaching to the symbol, grasping the symbol as being the reality. If I said, you see the Buddha sitting up there on the shrine? That's the real Buddha. That is Buddha. You'd think, Ajahn Sumedho has gone really crazy. Yet we can still attach to a perception of Buddha as Buddha. We're not at the stage where we're going to believe that that vast statue is Buddha, but we can be very attached to a view about the Buddha. And it might be a very nice view, just as that Buddha Rupa is a very nice Buddha Rupa. I like that Buddha. It's very beautiful. And we don't have to get rid of it, because Buddha Rupas do not delude. What is dangerous is our attachment to a perception of self, of others, of Buddha, of God, of oneness, of wholeness. So any questions? Thoughts? Yes. Anagarika Evgenia.
Maybe about this quality of despair that most of the people on spiritual journey go through. In your experience, what would be the cause for this, and how people do resolve it? Is it just passes with time, and or is mostly, like in most cases, there is some misperception, like some common delusion that people go through in this stage of despair?
So if you could, so you're asking how do people get through that, or?
Yes, both. Why do they encounter it? Like, is it something common for everybody, or is it some specific, like case by case, the cause, and how do people go through it?
Is it common? I would say it's extremely common. It's like Lumpur Cha said, everyone who enters into monastic life, you should expect to shed tears at least three times. When I've quoted that, a few people said, ha, only three? That was just yesterday. I'm not kidding. And so I said, well, boys don't cry. Ajahn Chah's, that being brought to the to your knees and brought to tears, that's very common. It's not always going to be the case, but I would say for most people at certain times, then that sense of complete loss or failure or everything being broken and it's just not working and it's all impossible, that's going to appear. I mean, it can be triggered by different things, and it might happen at different stages. It's those kind of aspects are quite unpredictable. But I feel that Hermann Hesse's description in that book, again, I did read it many, many years ago, but I felt at the time that it was there was that strong intuitive sense of, yes, it's exactly how it works. And trying to remember, okay, stay with the group and keep going. don't turn back. And that there's a in the suttas, there's a I think it's in the Book of the Fours in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses, the Buddha speaks about the four different types of spiritual practitioner, and it's a comfortable practice and slow insight, comfortable practice and quick insight, uncomfortable practice and quick insight, uncomfortable practice and slow insight. So there's kind of four. I mean, you could probably come up with more options. But so there is a category, comfortable practice and quick insight. But that, is, I think, is very, very rare, very unusual. And so for most people, there's degrees of discomfort, and also it's not usually that quick. For some people it is, somebody has a lot of paramita, they have a mind that is very mature, and even as a young child, they can have a profound understanding. Someone who's born with a lot of paramita and a lot of clarity and so on, that can be the case. But I would say mostly, and the kind of people I've been together with in the monasteries and on retreat with over the last 40 years or so, it's generally a difficult practice, and it might be slower, it might be quick, but the majority of people experience difficulty. But I felt that these kind of teachings that Lumpur is giving here is very helpful, because sometimes we can say, if we can feel that, well, if I was practicing well, I wouldn't feel as bad as I do now. This feeling of being a failure or being useless or nobody loves me or this is not working, that must mean, therefore, I'm doing it wrong or the practice doesn't work. And I would say that is most generally that's a really bad misunderstanding, and that again it was a very common theme of Lumpu Cha's if it's hard work and it's really challenging, that probably means you're getting it right. if it's easy and comfortable, it's probably that you're not challenging enough of your attachments and so on, and that So I feel that in terms of our training and our lives, it's good to not. I mean, and just because it's painful doesn't mean it's necessarily good. But that was the Buddha's insight into pointless asceticism. But we should, again, as Ajahn Chah put it, when you enter into spiritual practice, you should expect to experience a lot of friction and difficulty. That's like crossing the desert, yeah. That's, in a way, what we're asking for when we shave our heads, put on the robes, take on the discipline of monastic training. You're stepping out into a raw environment, a challenging environment. And even though that's not very cuddly or inspiring, it's like, oh, please tell me, Lumpur, we're all going to realize Nibbana, aren't we? We're all going to become arahants. Please tell us it's all going to end happily ever after. It's like, no. It might end happily or it might not. It's up to you. But that sense of realism, like, yeah, this is a big mountain to climb. It's a lot. The desert is very long and it's hot. There's not much water and not much to eat. So that when you enter into spiritual practice, you should expect a great deal of friction. You know the word friction? Yeah, friction and difficulty. That's to be expected. So when that's experienced, when you're finding it really hard to get up in the morning, or you find that you've eaten too much food again, or you find yourself having critical thoughts of the Ajahn or your fellow sisters or whoever, then it's like, ah, right. this is difficulty. This is friction. Okay. So that can validly be taken as a sign that, okay, this is to be expected. This is part of the training process. This is part of our practice. It doesn't mean that things are going wrong. And I feel if we have that as a model in our minds, if we have that as a framework, then we're much more ready to work with it. It's like if you want to get to the top of a mountain, you've got to expect some work to be done by your legs. It's going to be challenging for your legs and your lungs and... Otherwise, there's no way you can get to the top of the mountain. If that's where you want to go, that's what's going to be needed. And so it's a helpful, realistic approach, I find. And then, again, it's making it across the desert. I think one of the images of that story of Hermann Hesse is that the group were helping each other. It was a group that made it across the desert and made it to the east. And Sangha life is a lot about helping each other along the way. You know, that the support that we can give each other as we deal with those the difficulties and those frictions, and keeping a perspective on it. Okay. When you can truly free your mind from attachment, all these particular angles are valid. We're not condemning monism as monism, like monistic thinking, monism, oneness, as wrong. But attachment to monistic doctrine is limiting and binding, just like attachment to non-dualism. The purpose of non-dualism is really a tremendous pointing at attachment. But if you are just a philosophical non-dualist, you can be attached to a kind of annihilation attitude. So this is something that can happen. When I was living in California, then non-dualistic teachings and teachers were quite popular, and you sometimes would come across dueling non-dualists. A duel where people fighting each other. So dueling non-dualists. And sometimes in Buddhist magazines you get exchanges of letters between various non-dualist teachers, Advaita teachers. It's kind of funny how one is saying, you know, my non-dualism is more non-dualistic than your non-dualism. Which I wish I was joking, but I'm not. Unfortunately, I wish I was making that up, but I'm not. And it's like it's an absurd. Well, how can your non-dualism be more non-dualistic than somebody else's? And this, when I was traveling in India, I had a year in India on pilgrimage, and one of the people I was traveling with was Eric McCord, and he was part of the staff at Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. He'd been a Buddhist practitioner around Buddhist teachings for a long time, and he had a very clear-minded perception on this. And he said one day, "What really puzzles me is when somebody says, 'I'm really into non-dualism,' because I think, compared to what?" Because if you're comparing your non-dualism to something that's a dualistic, if you can follow that, you're comparing it to something else. So that it's a very dualistic way of relating to it. So a philosophy can be attractive and say, yeah, that sounds right, that sounds good. But then the mind that attaches to it says, yes, this is great. And then in that moment, it's comparing it to another thing. It's left that actual non-dual vision, that atamayata, and it's started comparing objects with each other and saying this object is more beautiful, more real than that object. And so it's fallen into those habits of perception and dualistic thinking, either comparing this to that, or comparing, or looking at in a dualism between subject and object. Not to get too wrapped up in that, but it's an important to see that the idea of Advaita, or the idea of Atamayata, the idea of non-dualism, is not non-dualism. It's not the actual vision, the actual realization that is not seeing the thing, not creating a dualistic vision. It's not that subjectless, objectless awareness. It's been born into discrimination. And so it doesn't mean that those philosophies are false or wrong, but what's happening is the attitude towards it, the way the mind has picked those up and said, yes, yeah, my team, my Advaita Vedanta teacher is far wiser or more liberated than your Advaita Vedanta teacher. And the content of what is being said might have a validity to it, but the way the mind picks it up, it can be something completely different, something else altogether. So that's an important aspect to bear in mind. And also, I thought that I would share with you this, where the one place where the Buddha is talking about sort of monistic doctrine, and it's from the very wonderful and comprehensive teaching, the very first sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, the root of all things, which in itself, just the title of the sutta is very meaningful. And the Buddha's talking about how attachment gets formed. And he starts off with the four elements, earth, water, fire, and wind, and so on, and then goes through different mind states and states of absorption and such like, describing this. And then along the way, so close to the end, he talks about the all, A-double-L, the all, in Pali, sabba, the all. And then it reads something like, he directly knows the all. He conceives himself as the all. He conceives himself in the all. He conceives himself apart from the all. He conceives the all to be mine. He delights in the all. Why is that? Because he's not understood. Because he's not understood it. And then it goes through the sutta, and the next one is Nibbana. You know, he directly knows Nibbana. He conceives himself as Nibbana. He conceives himself in Nibbana. He conceives himself apart from Nibbana. He conceives Nibbana to be mine. He delights in Nibbana. Why? Because he doesn't understand it. And then the second part of the sutta goes on to say, yeah, he directly knows water as water and so forth, the all as the all. He does not conceive himself as the all. He does not conceive himself in the all. He does not conceive himself apart from the all. He does not conceive the all to be mine. He does not delight in the all. Why is that? Because he has understood that delight is the root of suffering, and that with being as condition there is birth, and for whatever has come to be there is aging and death. Therefore, bhikkhus, through the complete destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishment of cravings, the Tathagata has awakened to supreme full enlightenment, I say. So that's sutta number one in the... it's a very long sutta, but that is one of the places where the Buddha talks about that monistic philosophy, and also about Nibbana in that same way. You know, if you think Nibbana is mine, or I am Nibbana, or I have... and I am that has conceived or has realized Nibbana, then that right there is because the mind has not understood it properly. And then another passage I thought in terms of this sort of letting go and the relinquishing of the kind of comforting, gladdening, inspiring, or sort of those monistic perceptions. Then you have these passages at the beginning of chapter 8 of the Udana. It's called the whole chapter is called Patali Village, and the Buddha gives these teachings about ultimate reality. He says, this is Udana, so chapter 8, sutta number 1. There is that sphere, that ayatana, the sphere of being, where there is no earth, no water, no fire, nor wind. No sphere of infinity of space, infinity of consciousness, of nothingness, or even neither perception nor non-perception. There is neither this world nor the other world, neither moon nor sun. This sphere, this ayatana, I call neither a coming nor a going nor a staying still, neither a dying nor a reappearance. It has no basis, no evolution, and no support. This, just this, is the end of dukkha. So again, when people hear that, they can say, no sun, no moon. I was enjoying that. I like the sun and the moon and the stars. And so there's something in us that goes, that quavers and quivers in that. And it can feel like a terrible loss. Well, that sounds really boring. We're like, wow, that sounds pretty awful. That's... But then the Buddha's final comment, this is the end of dukkha. So it's when he would make those kind of statements that people would say, well, that sounds pretty grim, or, I'm not interested in that. And that Lumpur is encouraging us to say, well, don't be put off. This is the kind of challenge where you're letting go of those familiar, comforting, cozy inspiring expressions of the teaching, and it's encouraging that complete letting go of time, of identity, of space, and all of those familiar landmarks, those familiar qualities that the mind identifies with. So he goes on to say the end of this teaching, I'm not asking you to attach to a position of non-dualism, but I have asked you not to try to inspire your mind or read about inspired monistic teaching and various other religions during this retreat. Because in order to really learn how to use this particular tool of these teachings and the forest tradition Theravada practice, you have to follow the instructions and observe the results. And it can seem pretty barren, but we have to let go of that need for inspiration, right up to that point of despair. We have to learn to accept that emptiness, that silence, the cessation, the loneliness, the lack of warmth, and not ask for benevolence and kindness. We have to be open to the silence and contemplate it, learning from it rather than running away from it and looking for a nice warm mother or a nice safe father. Then, one way you can describe this holy life is the growing up of an individual to that maturity where we no longer linger in the warmth of adolescence or childhood or in the pleasures of the world. So this is, in that same kind of spirit of realism, a sense of being ready to grow up, let go of our comfort, our toys, our precious teddy bear, and such like childlike comforts, and it can seem a bit sort of brutal or challenging, but it's that quality of being ready to turn towards the attachments, the things that we have taken comfort in, the things that we have relied on, and seeing that, well, yes, there's a certain comfort or a certain kind of warmth that comes from that, a brightness, but it's also very limiting. It's a prison that the heart needs to break out of. And often in terms of spiritual symbolism, people will use the image of a caterpillar breaking out of its chrysalis, the hard shell. When a caterpillar is evolving into a butterfly, then at a certain point in its evolution, it stops still and it forms this hard case of what's called the chrysalis around it, and then it's completely dissolved. All the cells of the caterpillar. Apparently, I remember from my biology lessons way back in high school, the biology teacher pointing out that when a caterpillar or a maggot, when they form into a chrysalis, that they dissolve completely into a kind of liquid, like a mush, and that all of the cells reorganize into a completely different form. And then when that maturation, that coming together has been fulfilled, then the chrysalis breaks open and the butterfly comes out. The caterpillar has to dissolve before the butterfly can emerge. And that is often a spiritual symbol. I think many different traditions have spoken about that. So the sort of the morbio inferiore, this challenge of letting go of the familiar, it's like if the caterpillar is attached to having all those legs and doesn't really want wings. I don't want wings. I like my big eyes, and all these legs are really handy. And as long as there's enough food to eat, if I can eat my leaves, then that's good. I'm great. Yeah, it's all good. And so the process of maturation is again, not trying to read into the mind of a caterpillar, but that recognizing, it's all changing. Then that coming to a place of stillness, stopping still, the hard case of the chrysalis forming, and then everything dissolving, all goes into a goop, and then the goop is that falling apart is part of the process of maturation. So if you feel like you're in the hard case of the monastic discipline and the precepts and the routine, and you have turned into goop, to be encouraged, to be reassured that if the process is allowed to work in its ordained way, then when that maturation has happened, then the chrysalis breaks open and the butterfly can emerge. And I thought I'd finish. There's a verse again from another spiritual tradition. I believe this comes from a teaching or a book that's called The Parliament of the Birds by Farad Uddin Attar. Again, is a spiritual spiritual tale, and in that, if I'm remembering this correctly, it comes from the collection of birds that are looking for their spiritual mentor, the Simurgh, and the birds are making this journey together, the Parliament of the Birds, and in the process of it. It says, And I think this is the Simurgh speaking when they've finally met reaching their goal. Again, I'm not absolutely sure this is the correct memory of it. But anyway, the poem that I noted down about the process goes as such. I drink my servant's blood, and he is hurled in frenzied turbulence around the world. And when he is destroyed and cannot find his head, his feet, his passions, or his mind, I close him in the splendor he has won, and grace enfolds him, radiant as the sun. So it's more dramatic than the Pali Canon usually. But I thought that was very similar. When he is destroyed and cannot find his head, his feet, his passions, or his mind, it's the kind of the experience that we can have, particularly solitary retreat, when all of the usual benchmarks and structures that we might use and rely on have departed. They're not there. So those can be really challenging, desperate, and difficult times. But then, when that's all been let go of, the effort to try and hang on to use those familiar benchmarks or the reference points for us, then the result is radiance, is freedom, as he puts it. I clothe him in the splendor he has won, and grace enfolds him, radiant as the sun. So that the result of that. That letting go, that the readiness to cross that desert to meet those challenges, is this great freedom, this great brightness of the heart that is the potential that we have. So I will leave it there for today.